EXOSKIN. If you go to our partners page, click on the banner, you can get 20% off using the code TRN.
Hey, we just had Carl Speed Goat Metzler on, and his podcast will be released in a couple weeks. But what we talked about was efficiency on the course, in and out of aid stations. And when you wear the right gear, the right socks, the right shirt, the right shorts, you are good to go. You don't have to make changes throughout the race.
Efficiency equals faster times. Get yours at exoskin.com or go to our partners page, click on that banner and get 20% off.
Put in code TRN.
Lakey Poles. We just got off the trail. Let's start that over. Lakey Poles. They're the best in the West.
You know, somebody that grabbed a pair of Lakey Poles to get ready for a race is Megan Laws. And really not a pole user, but needed to for a race. And tell us your experience.
Yeah, for Trans Gran Canaria. There's just a ton of climbing and it's very rocky. So, and it's in Europe. And if you want to, you know, improve your efficiency climbing up hills, it's been proven that using the poles does that. And since it's common to use them, I thought, well, I'm going to get some and I'm going to practice with them. And so I got some Lakey poles.
Did it make a difference for you?
Yes, huge difference. I was able to climb a lot faster.
So the race is over. Do you still know where they're located? Do you still like them?
Yeah, I do like them. A friend of mine is borrowing them for a race that they're allowed in. So yeah.
Well, the good news is with the discount code, they can get their own and at a cheap price.
Just go to our partners page. There's a Lakey banner there, and if you click on it, you can save yourself some money.
All right, I will tell him that.
Aftershocks, they make the best headphones for running of all time, and you don't need to just use them for running.
No, you don't. You can wear them anywhere, and I do. As you know, Scott, I'm an audiophile. I love headphones, and I have more than I'd care to admit. Almost as many pairs of headphones as I had shoes. And I keep going back to the Aftershocks because I just love the sound and love the open environment.
They have a new one. Actually, I have two new ones. The ones that we've been using are the AeroPex. They're lighter, longer battery life, and they have better sound with less leakage.
You don't ever want leakage, Scott, especially from your headphones. So go to our partners page.
You can get $55 off the Adventure Bundle, which includes any of those Bluetooth headphones, wireless headphones, and a whole bunch of really cool gear.
Yeah, thank you, Don. You know, I mean, I didn't know what it was going to be like. You know, you sound like a nice guy on this podcast, but
I know it's on the upper edge, and you guys have won a couple of awards, and
I've never prepped for a podcast ever.
Oh, that's what you're doing.
Thanks for joining another edition of Trail Runner Nation. I'm Scott Warr.
And I'm Don Freeman.
You know, a lot of us are fans of running.
Sure we are.
We're not only runners, but we're fans of running. And we know a little bit, or some of us know a lot about running. Some of us know a little bit about running and the history of running. And throughout history, there's been some kind of booms in running. I think the first one started back in the 70s when Jim Fix won the marathon. And
Scott, I think the first boom came in when the other tribe invaded your tribe and you had to get out of camp.
Or running after the antelope.
That was the first boom.
That was the first boom. Yeah. Okay, so the second boom was like in the 70s.
Yeah.
Then in like the 90s, that's when everybody, you know, finally figured out, hey, you don't have to be like this crazy elite runner to be a marathoner. Anybody can finish a marathoner. Oprah finished a marathon, for crying out loud. If she can do it, I'm not discounting Oprah's skills. But you know, anybody can if they put their mind to it, they can finish a marathon. And then we got into the 2000s when ultra running kind of became a boom, and we're probably still in that next boom of running where people are just really out there trying to become fit, and they find that they can just put on some shoes and get her done and run some of these crazy distance runs. And we're going to talk about today a book by Matthew Futterman, and Matthew's with us today. We'll introduce him in a minute, called Running to the Edge, A Band of Misfits and the Guru who Unlocked the Secrets of Speed. And that's what this book is. It's kind of like a history of from the 1970s till today of how running has evolved, not only the booms, but how it's evolved and how some of these coaches have changed the way that we think about running. And it's just a fascinating book. Matthew, thanks for joining us. Matthew, you're the the editor, an editor over at the New York Times right now. Is that correct?
That is correct. I'm the deputy sports editor here.
Deputy sports editor. So does it, do you have a badge for that?
I don't care. I wish I did. I was trying to make one up. Maybe since there isn't one, I could probably design it. So I'm thinking that it'll be like a winged foot or something like that.
Your own favorite shoe on there. That's a great idea. Not only that, not only an author and runs the sports department at the New York Times. He's also completed many marathons. Scott, how many marathons have you completed, Matthew?
I'm at 23. Yeah. So then I got a couple scheduled for this fall. So God willing, by mid-November, I'll be at 25. But I'm trying to keep the focus on the journey rather than the destination.
So Matthew, there's a lot of books on running, and you're a runner and a fan of running. I'm sure you've read a lot of books about running. Why did you need to write another book about running?
Oh, I didn't need to write another book about running, but I always wanted to. I love to run. I love to write. I love the tradition of the I love the literary tradition that is in running. There's a lot of sports that don't really lend themselves to or don't have a great literary tradition. But football comes to mind. There are not a ton of, you don't have every year these sort of new great pro football books coming out. But running is something runners really like to read. They like to read about their sport. And I think there's something meditative about it that sort of is very similar to both writing and reading. And it sort of promotes, it's an activity that really does promote thought. So I wanted to write a book about running because it's just about the thing I love most in the world. And I spend so much time doing it. It means a great deal to me. I know a lot about it. One of the first things they tell you in 10th grade English or whatever it is, when you start learning about writing and composition is write what you know.
Uh-huh.
And this is something that's very, very close to my heart. And I really wanted to explore it. I really wanted to find a story that was filled with the same kind of emotions and passions and the idea of rebelliousness that I feel like is at the heart of this sport and is something that I feel when I'm running or when I'm standing on a start line with 50,000 other people. And that was the story that I happened on to with this group of runners from the 1970s named the Hummel Toads and their unbelievable coach named Bob Larson.
Let's get into that. But I want to go back to the word that you stated or a phrase that you stated earlier. And I'm paraphrasing because my short-term memory is worse than my long-term memory, apparently. You said it's a thinking sport. It's a thinking activity. We like to think when we're out there. Why do you, can you speculate and we can kind of toss it around? Why do you think going out and running allows us to think, to lose a lot of the chatter that goes on through daily life? Can you speculate?
Well, I have a couple ideas on that. And that's not just like, by the way, it's not just my theory. It's like a proven thing where they've done psychological tests of putting people on treadmills and having them do tasks while they're in motion. And apparently we are more effective at doing thinking tasks while we are moving. There's something about the activity that spurs thought. But on a more sort of anecdotal level in terms of what I experience, and I don't run with my phone. I almost never wear headphones or listen to music. So what I, one of the things I do focus on is my thoughts and the sounds around me. And so it's really my quiet time. And I think that's what it is for a lot of people. And when things are quiet, when the world is not invading you every minute, I think that's an opportunity to have some deep, really revelatory moments.
I think that we all feel we've solved all of the world's problems at the end of a run. By the end of the run, you're thinking, I have this figured out.
That's why we stand around in the parking lot afterwards. We're planning out all these things we've solved. You know, and I have a theory with that too. And interesting that they have walking desks and, different types of treadmill desks and things, because I think we do feel more productive and we have clearer thoughts. But if you look back anthropologically, I think we needed to think best when we're on our feet. Mm-hmm. We're chasing an animal or we're being chased by something. We need to be at our best at that moment because that's do or die at that point in our life. So I think it's those that could think while they're running or moving survived and reproduced and passed that along to the next generation. So I think that's where it came from. I mean, if we're hypothesizing and we're establishing truth on this podcast, and then we'll just go ahead and
We're establishing truth on this podcast?
I don't know.
We've done 435 podcasts. Well, are you kidding? Is this the time?
It's time to start. So running to go ahead.
I think it's also just connected to happiness too, because I don't know a lot of people who are miserable when they're in motion. I mean, I guess there are some people out there who just like to sit in a chair all day. But I think we're sort of active social animals, and we like the feeling that we get when we're going from point A to point B, and when we're able to do that on our feet often or under our own power. There's something very sort of primal and elemental about it.
You know, Don and I were just on a run a couple days ago, and I didn't want to go. It was early in the morning. I didn't want to go. In fact, I texted him and said, I'm not going. And he didn't get the text, so he showed up at my door and honked his horn and woke up all my neighbors, and I ended up going. And at halfway through the run, I said, you know what? I've never gone on a run and finished and thought, man, I wish I wouldn't have done that. It was just a lot of fun. And you're right. There is some joy and happiness that comes from that.
I think it's the Bobby Kennedy line, in life we never regret the things we do, only the things we don't do.
Mm. Ah, very good. Hey, so the book, I'm going to say this may, you have written this book in such a way that it is a true story. You write it in a story manner as you're educating and putting forth the facts. And the story that you come up with, I was not aware of. There's some familiar names, but there's a lot of names that I wasn't aware of. Talk to us about this band of misfit runners and a guru or this coach. Tell us a little bit about that. Give us a synopsis.
Well, it all starts with the coach, Bob Larson, who spent the first dozen years of his life in Minnesota on a farm with no running water and no electricity. And he always loved to run, mainly because he didn't have a choice. And that was his first introduction to running. It was a couple miles to school. It was, you know, a half mile to the other part of the farm. And the best way to get there was to run. And he always just loved the activity. And he was also pretty fast. But he didn't know much about it until his father had a farming accident and had to move to San Diego because he couldn't run a farm anymore. And that's where Bob Larson sort of comes of age as a runner in high school and falls in love with the sport. And he's pretty fast, and he goes to San Diego State, and he's competing on the cross-country team. And this is the late 50s, and they're doing the same workouts that everybody did back then, which is doing just these crazy intervals, quarter miles and half miles and repeats, and they're wrecking his shins and giving him stress fractures. And the summer between his freshman and sophomore year, his coach tells him, make sure you do some training so you're in some kind of condition when you come back in September. And he doesn't live near the school, so he goes out for runs on his own on the streets of San Diego. And you know, that sounds like the most normal thing in the world to us, but I can't tell you what a crazy thing that was to do back in 1958 when no one is running. And he's running out there in the evenings after he spends all day working at a gas station, and he feels himself getting stronger. And some nights he goes for 3 miles, and some nights he pushes it for 5 miles, and some for 7 miles. And at the end of the summer, he runs something called the Balboa 8 Mile, which is one of the first sort of distance races in the country. And he blows everybody away. And what he realizes is that thing he was doing all summer, it liberated both his heart and his mind. And it really turned him into a terrific distance runner. And what he learned through that, and what he later learned because he became something of a sports scientist himself and doing research with a guy named Fred Cash, is they happened onto this unbelievably revolutionary idea, which again sounds so simplistic from the 2019 point of view, that the heart is actually like any other muscle. If you train it, it will get stronger. And that went completely against conventional wisdom of the 1960s, which was, if you strain your heart, if you push yourself after the age of about 35, you're going to risk a catastrophic cardiac event. And that's not what Bob felt when he was running on those streets in San Diego. That's not what the early studies that his professor, Fred Cash, was doing at San Diego State. That's not what they were showing when he would have these adults come and train a couple of nights a week, showed that their hearts were getting more efficient. And that becomes the sort of foundation of Bob's concepts and his approach to running as he becomes a high school coach and then a junior college coach and then the coach at UCLA. It's this primal belief in the power of the heart, and that the run is a means to understanding what is inside someone's heart, both from a physical and a metaphysical point of view. And that if you push yourself to that edge and you force both your heart and your mind to do the uncomfortable thing, to do the thing that scares you, to become comfortable with being uncomfortable, mm-hmm. that's where the real magic can happen. That's where the strength can come from. And that's the idea that cultivates these hippie runners in San Diego who call themselves the Humboldt Toads, who come together and come out of nowhere to win the 1976 National Cross Country Championships, back when that was just about the biggest race outside of the Boston Marathon.
Hey, Matthew, if we can pause for just a second, I've got a couple of thoughts as I listen to all of that. 1958, because I wasn't there then, thankfully, that you would drive through town and not see any runners at all. I mean, it's common now that we see people bouncing down the road with, you know, some shoes on, but that would be unusual to see that. I guess
that would be as weird to go outside and walk down the street naked. extent that anybody was running, it was happening on a track.
Huh?
Nobody ran on road. It just didn't happen. Ask anybody who did run back then if they ever saw another runner, and they will all to a person tell you, no, I never saw another runner back then. I was alone out there.
That's such a change. And we would never think of it. Yeah.
Right. It's not very long ago. It was that way probably up through most of the 1960s. It's not until we get to the 70s and you start, Frank Shorter wins the 72 Olympic marathon, that's sort of looked at as something of the sort of seminal moment, or the first seminal moment in road racing and road running. And there were some more of them, but it was really, really a fringe kind of punk rock activity almost.
Amazing. You know, I like the word that you used at the beginning of the podcast. You said that running is a rebellious sport, it's kind of that punk rock thing
and counterculture.
Yeah. And I think that even, as running has become more mainstream in the 80s, 90s and 2000s, I think that's why trail running has become, such a force out there, is because it's considered the punk rock thing. You know, you don't wear normal shorts, you don't wear the normal singlet when you're out on the trails. So I like that we're part of this punk rock group.
Now, I had a couple of other comments from that from the narrative there. 2019. So when Bob Larson made his observations, he was taking a leap of faith because they didn't have the tools that we have today. So you said looking back at 2019, it seems elementary. Yeah, of course. But he didn't have access to heart rate monitors and watches
Max
and watches that counted cadence and all those different things that help put the puzzle together that say, yeah, that makes sense. He didn't have that, so he was really out on his own trying to figure this out.
No, he was stopping his runners, and he would do this. I mean, he was running these sort of experiments on his high school runners at Monta Vista High School, where he would send them out, he would take their pulse rate, he would have an A group and a B group, and he would test their pulse rates doing different distances and compare them to each other. That was the science that was essentially available to him at that moment. And, you know, even that he was even trying to attach numbers to it and trying to actually figure out what was the best way to teach your body how to run really, really far, really, really fast. The idea that there could be data attached to it, that was a very sort of rebellious activity in itself. That was just not something that was done. This is very, very, very early in the sort of science of sports. And it's funny to think about because, you know, we're getting ready to send somebody to the moon, women prime ministers, the Russians have invented a cell phone. I mean, the modern age has dawned at this point. It has happened. But, to the extent that anybody knew anything about distance running or training, they just knew very, very little.
Go ahead, Scott.
How did you get to know about this Bob Larson and the Toads story? Did you know a little bit about it, or how did you come upon this story? I'd never heard of it.
Well, I came upon it backwards, actually. I'd known Bob for a couple of years because he's Meb Keflezighi's coach. Uh-huh. And so I got to know him through covering Meb. And I got to be, you know, friendly with him, and we'd call on him and ask him some questions. And then the day before the 2015 Boston Marathon, I was in Boston. I got Bob invited me to a documentary that had been made about him by one of his former runners, a guy who ran with the Toads, actually. And it was largely about Bob and Meb, but in that documentary, there was sort of some snippets of early stuff about his early days and his early work and those sort of foundational years with the Toads. And I looked at this picture of that 1976 team, and they've got scraggly beards. They look kind of like the Eagles or the Doobie Brothers or the Band or some other rock group from then. And I just looked at those guys and I thought, man, I got to get to know them. Like that's the part of running that I've always been drawn to. This sort of, like we've said before, that sort of fringy part of it. And, you know, I think a lot of that happens on the trails in an overt way. But I do think that since we haven't had to run for thousands of years, so the idea that we would go out and run 20 miles on a Saturday morning, whether you're doing it on a trail or doing it on a road or doing it in a big city marathon or just doing it with your buddy, like that in itself is kind of an act of rebellion against the modern age.
So rebellion, and you describe this group with straggly beards and they look rebellious. Was their training or racing philosophy rebellious as well? Did they get out there and run differently than had been, you know, standard?
Well, they did. I mean, first of all, they just hammered.
Yeah.
You know? they really did. And I mean, what was rebellious about it is that to the extent you had any schools at all, you had two schools of thought. You had the Eastern Europeans. Their hero was Zatopek, Emil Zatopek, who won the 5,000, 10,000 in the marathon in 52. And Zatopek had those crazy workouts of doing 60 or 70 quarter miles with like a minute rest in between, all of them at 65 seconds or so, just mind numbing hamster wheel stuff. That is the antithesis of going out and running on a trail, for instance.
I had to rewind that, Matthew. You said 65 seconds and, multiple quarter mile loops. And I said, what? How many? 60 to 70? Real? Did I hear that right?
You heard that right.
It's
lunatic stuff.
Yeah.
And then on the other side was the Lydiard School, which is the, you know, train but don't strain, lots of volume. And Bob has these two questions, which is, why do the intervals have to be so short and why do the long runs have to be so slow? And what comes from that is threshold training and tempo runs. And that is really the sort of breakthrough that he pushes on his runners. So to the extent that they're training differently, they're going out on a Saturday morning and they're doing 3 or 5 miles of warm up, and then they're starting to hammer for 5 or 7 or 10 miles, and then they're slowing down for a couple of miles. It's those moments when they're pushing together and pushing each other. And that's really key too, because I mean, the three elements are the threshold runs, the training as a group, because Bob firmly believes, you know, both in the 60s and 70s, and then later when it becomes really important that you know, the power of the pack is in the wolf, and the power of the wolf is in the pack, that we push each other. And when we're running together, that we run as individuals, but we run as teams as well. That your strength really comes from leaning on the people that are with you. So those are two of the tenets. And the other is, you know, where you're born and how you're born and who's sponsoring you and how much money you have. That's not your destiny. Your destiny is what you make of it. And you can be better tomorrow than you were yesterday if you go to your edge, if you push yourself, if you do the uncomfortable thing and teach yourself to be okay with that and be in the scary part.
It sounds like the coach blended the two together, the crazy multiple laps around that track with the long slow. He said, it sounds like both camps have something. Maybe the real answer is where they intersect in the middle.
Yeah, there's a third way there. And also, you know, he was also very early on in trail running. You know, when he was a 23-year-old coach at Monta Vista High School and he called his first cross-country practice, you know, the guy showed up. First of all, they expected to see an old guy in a windbreaker with a clipboard and a whistle. And they didn't see that. They saw a 23-year-old guy in shorts and running and whatever existed as running sneakers back then. And he was going with them. And the second thing that surprised them is they didn't go to the track. They went out the back door of the school and they went up out on the dusty trails in the East County of San Diego, because he believed in that. He believed in running was liberation.
Hmm. And the shoes, you mentioned the shoes. He was forward thinking in that space too. Didn't he have, I remember hearing in the book, or I'd say reading, that he'd look at the shoes and he'd put some pads where the athletes were actually striking the ground?
Yeah, there was a lot of like garage band stuff with running back then. I mean, you had Bowerman on Oregon creating the waffle sole in his kitchen. And then, you know, people like Larson who are into this stuff. I mean, the shoes, there wasn't a running shoe market. So you had to sort of buy these flats. And if you needed extra cushioning, you know, you'd buy rubber and you'd trace it out and you'd cut it and glue it onto the bottom of the shoes for a little extra cushioning, if that was your thing. He was also very forward thinking in that he would take his runners down to the beach and he would have them run, do sprints barefoot and do intervals barefoot on the beach, because he believed very strongly in building up the muscles in your feet that way, and also naturally being able to run the way our bodies first ran thousands of years ago when we were on the Serengeti chasing antelopes.
And to that point, it was the heel strike, the extended stride versus the shorter stride with the 4 foot strike is I think what he was discovering.
Yeah, he's a big mid-heel strike kind of person, but yeah, it's the idea of just running the way your body wants it to run, and then you can adapt that to when you do put the shoes on. But he was, and this is, I mean, keep in mind, you know, what Born to Run came out in 2009 or something like that.
Yeah.
you know, this is 1965 and he's having guys run barefoot on trails. And if you look at pictures of his runners in meets, many of them are barefoot because that's where they grew comfortable running. And so they would go out to run a cross country race, and they would kick, they wouldn't wear shoes for it.
It, wow. It follows that hippie culture, man. You wear your long beard and bare feet, right?
Absolutely.
But not good for corporate America, because no. We need to sell some dang shoes. And 300 miles, you toss them out and get some new ones.
Well, I would say, in defense of corporate America here, my friend Jordan Metzl, the sports medicine physician, he said there was nothing better for his practice than when Born to Run came out. Because you had all these people in New York kicking off and running barefoot. And as he likes to say, you know, if you're a Mexican Indian, it's okay to probably run barefoot because you've been doing it your whole life. But if you're, you know, Melvin Goldberg and you're a dentist on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, really bad idea to run barefoot through Central Park.
Yeah, you got to start at 4 years old, not 40 years old.
I would think so, yeah.
Hey, let's get into these toads, the Humboldt toads. Tell us a little bit about that and who this group was and how he got involved, and it's just a fascinating story of how they ended up winning the national championship at such a small junior college.
Well, when I started to write the book and I saw that picture of these guys, I started dialing them up and asking them a very simple question, which is, why did you run? Because, you know, these were going to be my main characters, and I needed to know before I embarked on this that they were going to be vivid people. And I thought that it all started with if they had a real passion for this pursuit. And not one of them told me, I don't know, I was just kind of fast and I just did it. I didn't really think about it. I liked it, whatever. That was nothing. You know, Ed Mendoza, who eventually, you know, makes the Olympics in 1976 in the 5,000. I mean, this is a guy who's 5'5" tall, and he was always small growing up, and he was a terrible athlete. And, you know, we'd go down to the park and his little sister would get picked for teams before he did. And he really, his body felt like his body had no purpose until he started running in high school. And all of a sudden he started to feel comfortable with who he was, not just as, you know, not just in terms of his mind, but also who he was as a physical being. And that's sort of a very meaningful story to me. You went down the line with the other people. I mean, you had Terry Cotton, who lost a sibling, and he would never really talk. He was very quiet and very remote, but he had this fierceness with the way he approached running and his teammates. That's how they came to know that this is the place where Terry would sort of deal with his grief. And then, you know, he had a guy like Kirk Pfeffer, who was very socially awkward, another quiet guy, who really only felt comfortable, you know, not in class making friends in the schoolyard, but when he was out alone. And he started running when he was 6 and 8 years old, and he would wake up early in the morning and actually run around his block because he loved the smell of the flowers and the eucalyptus in San Diego. I had another guy, Dale Fleet, who desperately wanted to run because he needed a scholarship because his parents were fighting all the time, and he had to get out of his house for college, and he didn't have any money. And so you had time and again all of these stories of these guys who are not the blue chip runners who are getting recruited to run for Oregon necessarily, although one of them did get recruited to run for Oregon. Mm-hmm. These were guys who were a bit fringy and were sort of trying to make something of themselves through their sport, both, you know, for themselves in a kind of spiritual way, but also, you know, to try and accomplish something competitively.
Oh, go ahead.
No, please. How did these band of misfits come together into this cross-country team that Bob's running?
Well, Bob always had this dream of taking a local team and going up against the clubs that were emerging. So what he would describe as the fancy clubs, like New York Athletic Club and Greater Boston and Colorado and the Oregon Track Club. And these were places, these were the sort of handful of kind of hotbeds of running that existed back then. And I mean, he was very, sort of, he's a very sort of cheeky, kind of a wiseacre personality. You know, Jamul is like this total backwater in eastern San Diego. There's almost nothing there. And so the whole reason he named his team Jamul Athletic Club, because it was like the last place in the world you would ever have an athletic club. An athletic club was a thing that would happen in, you know, with the upper crust of Philadelphia or with New York. So he had this idea that he would have this team of locals from San Diego, and that they would go and they would go up against these other clubs, which essentially had, I don't know if ringers is the right term, but they would draw from a much broader base. I mean, Colorado was essentially an extension of the Colorado University of Colorado track team, and New York Athletic Club. I mean, New York was a massive metropolitan area. That was the best runners in a place that was, you know, back then, I want to say maybe 15 million people in the New York metropolitan area. Oregon, again, an extension of the Oregon track club, of the University of Oregon track team. So he always wanted to take just a group, and he pulled these guys together. There was this group in West County who called themselves the Toads, and a group in the East County, which was Rob's group, which was the Jamul Athletic Club. And his idea was, why are we competing against each other? Let's form one team. Let's take the best of us, and let's go see if we can surprise some people on the national level.
And they certainly did.
Why? Tell us the story of how they came up with the Toads.
Well, that was that group. You know, they used to always give each other a hard time and say, "You're slow as a toad, so you can beat that guy. He's slow as a toad." So they too were a little cheeky, and their idea was, what's the last thing that a running team would ever call itself? And it would be the Toads. And one of their members was a graphic designer, and he actually designed their logo, which was a toad wearing a running singlet. And there was they all wore these running singlets with the toad on their singlet, and that toad is wearing a singlet. And so the idea is that it's a toad inside a toad inside a toad, and it goes on forever.
Are the Toads still around?
The members of that team are still around. The Toad sort of still kind of exists. It has its I don't want to say ups and downs, but it has its flourishes. And it's lack of flourishes, but you still see people wearing Jamul Toad singlets at races. Oh, yeah. You still see them wearing t-shirts. There's still guys who get together and run as the Toads. They're not as big and robust a team as you might have in some other areas. They're still out there. They are still beloved.
Gosh, I would wear a toad shirt in a second. Put those on your website.
Put those on your website.
I don't know. You know, I don't own the rights to those. I can't sell those. But I do have a toad singlet, and I wear it in every marathon I run.
Do you really? Oh, that's
absolutely
awesome. We need to get a picture. You need to send us a picture of that. We'll use that as a podcast photo.
Hey, so one of the things that I've, you know, I'm still amazed at from the very first time that I got passed, which was often, you know, even till today, is that body types that come in all different mm-hmm. forms, that you can be passed by someone, you know, twice your age or twice your size, or someone that you look at that you think probably isn't a runner at all. If you were standing in line at the grocery store, you wouldn't think that they even ran a step ever, but they pass you out there on the road or the trail. And at Ed Mendoza at 5'5", I'm fascinated that you can never predict how a person will perform when they put on a pair of shoes and go out there and run. I just love that part.
Yeah. I mean, I, one of the things I love about this sport is there's still a lot we don't know. I mean, there's a lot that we do know. And there's a lot that we can work backwards. I mean, we can study Eliud Kipchoge, or Scott Jurek, or some of these people that have great success, and then we can explain why they are good. But if we looked at them when they were 18 or so, we wouldn't necessarily be able to say, oh yeah, they're going to be legends. So it's there's still a fair amount of mystery to this sport, and you know, a lot of it has to do with, so much of this is mental. I mean, look, you got to have a good engine. Right. There's no, if you want to compete at the highest level, you got to have some, you got to have some good genes and be born with some gifts. But you also have to have the ability to invite the pain, and you have to be able to do some scary things. Yeah. And you have to have that moment in the last mile or the last 100 meters or whatever it is in a race when you get pushed and you answer and you find that other gear that you didn't know existed before. You have to not just have the other gear, but you have to have the courage to believe that you have that other gear, because a lot of people discover what they have in that moment of truth.
Yeah, so interesting that you can't look at a body type and say, yes, runner, nope, gymnast, you're a swimmer. With running, it can be anybody or anything. With a basketball team, if you were shorter, height challenged, you probably wouldn't find a uniform that would fit you. They would look like pants in an oversized shirt that you would wear. But with runners, I think the things that you were talking about, those gifts are invisible. You can't see into the mind and see the determination, or you can't see the size of the lungs and the efficiency of their metabolic system to say, you know what, you've got quite an engine there, but we just can't see that engine. And so
you can't see that. I mean, there are certain things we know. I mean, you can have an advantage if you are a little on the smaller side and a little on the slight side because you have less surface area and your body can cool itself a little better. So you can be more efficient in that sense. But, you know, what makes a champion? There's a thousand different things that makes a champion. And, you know, and we all have some of those gifts. That's why hundreds of thousands of people can cross a marathon finish line every year. And, you know, there are a lot of gifts that even the best runners in the world don't have.
You know, you mentioned in the book that running, like most sports, is a copycat endeavor. And I think that we get in a rut in many cases that says, you know what, this is Meb's training plan. If I want to run like Meb, I got to do exactly like he does. I need to follow his training log. Or if I want to run like Scott Jurek, I need to be a vegan and I need to run and do the same things that it says in his training log. And that's not always the case. We're individuals that, I mean, there's some guiding principles. And in the book, you talk about some of those have been broke, those paradigms that Bob Larson, I think you brought this up in the book, that Bob had the theory that if you want to run far fast, you run far fast in training, right?
Yeah.
Did I get that right?
Yes, basically, yeah. I mean, look, there's three things that people who want to get better at this, pretty much all of them just do these three things. You got to do the long runs. You have to do the threshold runs, those sort of mid-range hard runs. And then you got to do some speed work. You got to do some 800s or mile repeats. That's if you want to keep getting better and try and set PRs and stuff like that, which not everybody should necessarily want to do. I mean, I think there's a great argument for just being a part of this massive humanity, being a part of something larger than yourself. That's a lot of the reason that I run. And I mean, not to seem too platitudinous here, but like 2020 is my year of putting down my watch and doing the next thing I'm afraid of, which is trail running. I've never really done it, and I've got to try it, because I'm pretty scared of it, but I feel like it's going to be really good for me. I'm 50 years old. I want to shake things up a little bit. I've been on this treadmill, so to speak, of chasing marathon PRs and chasing that distance. And a friend of mine said to me, like, I think you ought to get out on the trails. I think it'll be good for your legs. You'll find some different muscles. You'll expand yourself. You'll expand your mind. You'll get out of your Garmin. And when you come back to the road, you'll probably be stronger. So I'm really looking forward to that. And so that's my that's my big goal for 2020.
We're both laughing right now.
we're ready because we know
you're going to get hooked.
Okay. So the only time you go back to the road is to get back to the trail. So, so you're done running on the road unless you're traveling somewhere and you don't know where the trail is. So
you're running from a mugger or something.
Now, let us just share with you some of the beauty of the trail. And the smartest thing you said was, let me put down the Garmin, because you're right. When you realize that your 8-minute pace on the road translates to a 10-15 pace on the trail, you will say, what is going on with me? But in fact, you know, that may be kind of the comparison. Yeah, the equivalent. Boy, every step is different. You want to talk about just losing yourself quick. It does happen on the road, but when you're out there in nature and you're listening to the birds and hearing your foot strike on different objects and maybe a river off to the left-hand side or just whatever you're hearing, maybe some wildlife crossing the way or you're sharing the path with, wow, what a fantastic experience on the trail.
Or a bear or a snake.
There's no cars to worry about. There's no stoplights to race. There's no crosswalks to have to wait your turn. It's all yours out there. And it doesn't take about 4 or 5 steps for you to realize that this is your place. And very much like if you look back in the eons of times that we say, well, we're built to run. We weren't running on across sidewalks and crosswalks. We were running on exactly the exact path that you find out there, wherever it is, was probably run by your ancestors and hopefully, you know, people beyond us. The trail is the best.
Can you see that Don's passionate about trail running?
Yeah, that's what I want to experience, and I you know, the challenge of it, I think, is because, you know, you can lose yourself a little bit on the trail, but you can't lose yourself too much. So you have to sort of get into that zone where you're thinking hard about where your foot's going to land on that next step so that you don't, you know, trip over and lose your teeth. But the act of doing that sort of becomes kind of meditative in itself. And that becomes sort of an instinctual reaction, is my theory. And then once you're able to do that, then the potential for really expanding your mind and letting your mind go is even greater than it might be, say, in Central Park.
You're right. You because you're so engaged with what's happening, the terrain and the root or the rock or the hole or the puddle or whatever is out there, you have to focus so much on that you do lose yourself more. I think you could carry some of the weight of everyday life on the road because there isn't any risk out there. But in 3 or 4 steps, you need to remove yourself from the car seat you were just in and really focus. And I think that's what's so beautiful about it, is you have to put yourself there.
Yeah. So that's where I'm headed. Looking forward to it. I'm a little scared of it because you mentioned bears and snakes. I actually have that crazy fear of snakes where I really can't be in a room with a snake. I start to freak out. I ran into a grizzly bear in Grand Teton hiking with my brother in 1999. I've been spooked by that ever since. I read, what's her name? Katie, the book Running Home that came out. Oh. You know, Katie, she won, is Katie Rogers? She won Leadville a couple years back. And it's a beautiful book about dealing with the grief over her loss of her father. And she has a great line in there that one thing ultra runners say is that you may not have seen the mountain lion, but the mountain lion has seen you, which is pretty terrifying to me. You know, I've lived on the Upper West Side of Manhattan for 20-something years. So this is going to be an adjustment.
No, another thing about the trail, which is so beautiful, is you get to hike. On the road, if you stop running your pace, then you are kind of letting yourself down or you're failing a bit. That's the way I take it. Now maybe everybody else may be different, but I'm just sharing with you that if I start walking, I'm hoping that people aren't recognizing I'm in running shorts and not just walking shorts. But on the trail, it becomes a strategy. It's not, now hiking up this hill is what you're supposed to do. You don't have to run up that thing. So, you know, it's a wonderful change.
I think we've convinced him, Don.
Well, I just like talking about it.
Hey, I wanted to get back to the book.
Oh. We're converting a roadrunner.
I just need to interrupt. Yeah, yeah. I assume you have editing capabilities.
No.
I have to go in like 3 minutes.
Oh, good. Okay. Oh, yeah.
So this is the one thing that I want you to comment on. You talk about, and I was not aware of this, that between, I don't know what year and the 1980s, that Americans slowed down while Japanese and Africans sped up. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think what happened, it's interesting, Alberto Salazar has been in the news recently. I think what happened is we took a false lesson from Salazar, who was the best runner in the world, gifted, everyone trained, no one trained harder than he did. And then his career ran into a wall when he was 26 years old. And he and people thought, well, if you run as hard as he did, you're gonna run out of steps. That people got this idea that you had a limited amount of steps that were there in your life before your body broke down. So people stopped running 120, 140 miles a week, and they started running 90. They stopped winning. They lost financial support. People started training alone. And it just didn't work. And there's Bob Larson getting ready to retire from UCLA, where he's been, you know, creating Olympic medalists in the 400 and the hurdles and all kinds of other distances throughout the 80s and 90s. And he wants to go back to his passion, and he wants to bring long distance running back to where it is. And so what he does is he looks at the East Africans and he studies them, and they're becoming dominant. And he says, you know what they're doing? They're doing what I did with the Hummel Toads back in the 70s. Mm-hmm. They're doing threshold runs. They're training as a group. And the one other wrinkle that they have folded in is, in addition to understanding that they can make their own destiny because none of them have any money, is they're training at elevation. And so he creates a group. And the sort of modern version of the Hummel Toads is the Mammoth Track Club. And he and Joe Vigil take a bunch of runners up to Mammoth Lakes, and they train at elevation, and they do the workouts that the Toads did back in the 70s. And lo and behold, in 2004, Meb Keflezighi wins the silver in the Olympic marathon, and Dina Castor wins the bronze. There's six medals, no marathon medals at the Olympics, and that little group in Mammoth, which was about a dozen runners, had two of them. That's a pretty good ratio.
Fantastic. This is a fantastic book. Running to the Edge, A Band of Misfits, The Guru Who Unlocked the Secrets of Speed. We know you have a meeting to go to, Matthew. We appreciate the time that you spent with us. And if you like this conversation, you'll love the book because he goes into detail. A couple of the things that I wish we had time to talk about, but you guys can discover it in the book. Comfortable with becoming uncomfortable. I like that. Become comfortable with that. And the strength in the pack. Those are a couple of topics that would be great to dive into because we all experience it out there. We know that we team up with other runners. When things get hard, when it becomes night or the hills get tough or the heat gets tough, you gather up as a group because there's strength in that. And I just love that stuff. Matthew Futterman, thank you so much for joining us.
Well-written book. I love that you make it each of these toads, you have a story for each of them, and it's very well told.
Yeah, well, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. And you know, you mentioned those ideas of becoming comfortable with being uncomfortable and relying on the group. I mean, that stuff really spoke to me because you know, that's stuff that can help you in running, but I think it really helps you in life too.
Yes.
I wouldn't do what I do unless I thought that there were some larger lessons here, and it's really important to me. So it really means a lot to me that this all spoke to you.
Well, great. This book is available anywhere books are sold. Scott and I went to Audible. We downloaded it there and listened to it on some runs. It's also on runningtotheedgebook.com. You can get it directly there, Amazon, anywhere you can go. Matthew Futterman, thank you so much. We appreciate you.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Okay, get to your meeting. Thank you, Matthew.
Great. Thanks a lot. We'll talk to you again.
Yeah, we'll tag you when this is coming out, okay?
Great. I really appreciate it.
3 weeks. Yeah.
3 weeks. Okay. Excellent. Okay.
Bye.
Where are you guys? Where are you located?
Sacramento.
Ah, okay. I got to get there. I'll be I'll be in I have two kids at Berkeley, so going to visit them in a couple weeks.
If you come out, we will introduce you to some killer world-class trails. We'll take you on your first trail run.
He'll be running by then, but Western States Trails out here, we've got so many great runs. Please call us when you get out here. We'd love to take you for a run.
Great. Sounds great.
We're not fast.
We're slow.
Neither am I.
Okay, bye-bye.